So I'm going to do something different. I look for and try to understand. Okay, I'm a medical doctor. I like to make sure I get the diagnosis right. Okay, and in order to get the diagnosis right, you sometimes have to take what's being said, and you have to kind of analyze it pretty thoroughly to make sure that you're getting the diagnosis right. Because you can offer all kinds of therapies, but if you don't have the diagnosis right, then you're going to make mistakes. And so what I try to do in all of my work is I try to understand, what would we have to believe about the human being, or in this case, what would we have to believe about morality and the human being in order for some of our claims, our scientific claims, to be true, okay? And so we're going to take some of these concepts apart, and we're going to look at what holds them together, okay? All right. So let's get going. All right, I like to start with a couple of quotes from Polanyi, Mikhail Polanyi. He was a physical chemist. Then he started studying philosophy. He has a brother named Karl Polanyi, and Karl Polanyi was a historian of economics, of economic philosophy. A really brilliant family. He says, scientific maxims and the art of interpreting them may be said to constitute the premises of science, but I prefer to call them our scientific beliefs. These premises, or beliefs, are embodied in a tradition, the tradition of science. Now, this goes fundamentally against what science has always thought about itself, which is we're throwing off tradition in order to get to the truth of the matter, right? We're throwing off tradition. But Polanyi, a physical chemist, actually out of his lab came two Nobel laureates. So two of his students became Nobel laureates. So he says, hey, we have a tradition and we have beliefs as scientists, okay? So I'm going to go through four movements. The first, I'm going to look at the relationship of early modern politics to science. And I'm going to go through in a little bit of detail the philosophy of the human sciences, or philosophy of social science, okay? Then we're going to look at what I call neuroscience as something that sits at the intersection of neurobiology and social science, okay? And I'll explain what I mean when we get there. And then I'm going to look at political schemes and technoscience, all right? All right, first movement. No, before we do that. Who painted this? Anyone know? Magritte, okay. And what does it say? This is not a pipe. This is not a pipe, right. Okay, I point this out to my medical students, and they're kind of confused, and then I say, well, you can't smoke that, right? So it's not a pipe, right? So we have to keep that in mind. Representations are not necessarily the realities, okay? So we have to keep that in mind as we move along. All right. All right. If you think about it, some of the greatest political thinkers were also our greatest scientific, what we call scientific today, natural philosophical. So if you think about it, Hobbes was the secretary to the chancellor, who was Francis Bacon, okay? And of course, we think of him as the author of the Leviathan and the Geometry King, right? He's trying to turn politics into a kind of geometric exercise, starting with axioms and moving forward, okay? We also have John Locke, who was a physician, who thought of himself primarily as a natural philosopher, who we think of as a political philosopher, with the two treatises on government, okay? So I'm going to focus on Bacon, because Bacon was a political operative his entire life. He was the chancellor. He was also what we would call the father of modern empiricism, okay? He wrote the New Organon, or the New Work. And I would argue, and I'm going to try to make this argument in the book that we're making, is that he's really the father of what we would call modern technoscience today, okay? And he has two ways of grounding both knowledge, but also morality. And the two ways are this. The epistemological justification of empirical knowledge is that if you can do something with it, with the information, it's true. It also turns out that that's the way patents are just patents in contemporary culture are defined. If you can get a patent, if you can take the information and you can do something with it, okay. So he's already kind of at the heart of modern patent law, okay, in that way. And the moral justification of knowledge is if we can relieve the human estate, okay. So I think he's the first person to be both a political thinker, but also a scientific thinker. And so these always go together. And I think this is going to be important. You'll see how this is important as we move forward, okay? All right, Polanyi again. No inanimate object is ever fully determined by the laws of physics and chemistry. And then one of my favorite quotes by Theodore Adorno, objects do not go into their concepts without leaving a remainder, okay? In other words, reality seems to overflow all our ways of thinking about it, okay? I want to keep that in mind as we move forward as well. All right. Second movement, philosophy of social science or philosophy of the human sciences. Now, the philosophy of the social sciences is very different from the philosophy of natural sciences, right? When we're studying a rock is pretty substantive. It's right there. It's kind of easy to get your hands on. It's easy to size up and to measure. But if you think about our certain kinds of concepts, like social ideas, like maybe, or psychological ideas, like intelligence, that's pretty squishy. That's not something you can really kind of size up very easily, right? And so when we start to talk about things like intelligence or spirituality or morality, we have to come up with a way of kind of fixing the idea or fixing the concept so that we can actually do something with the concept and begin to try to find a way to measure it. We can't just measure it like we measure a rock, because intelligence is something different than a rock, right? And spirituality is something different than a rock, and so is morality, okay? So, what happens in the philosophy of social sciences is first you have to have a conceptual definition, and your conceptual definitions can come from many different areas, right? You could look at, so I'll give you an example. There's a paper I will cite a little bit later by two psychiatrists called Meeks and Jesty. In there, they say, we're going to define wisdom. This is how we're going to define wisdom. It could be, you know, we could look at the Hebrew scripture. We could look at Christian scripture. We could look at different religious traditions. And then you come up with a conceptual definition based on the premises and the experiences of the religious tradition. Okay? So that's one way we can get at these definitions like morality, for instance, right? You can get the concept from our philosophical or our religious traditions, right? That's one way to do it. There are other ways that social scientists also say that we can do that. Grounded theory is an approach where we try to get at concepts, folk concepts, right, by talking to lots of people to see what they mean by morality or what they mean by spirituality, and then we can kind of get a crystalline definition out of that, so that we then have a conceptual definition. Then we have to take the conceptual definition and we have to operationalize it, okay? So we'll come up, let's say, with a conceptual definition of intelligence, and then we have to operationalize it, and we operationalize it by creating the operations, and the operations of an intelligence quotient test are the questions. Those are the operations. So the operations, the sum total of the operations, give us the conceptual definition, but the operations are the things are the way that we pick out an instance of intelligence right here, right? So we size him up, and we have all of these different operations that we can then say, aha, Stephen is intelligent, right? He has a certain IQ. Now we have to do the same thing. Conceptual definition of spirituality, conceptual definition of morality, conceptual definition of virtue. We then have to operationalize it in our science so that we can pick out an instance of it in the world. Okay? So that's the second step. Then we have to test the definition. And the way we test the definition is we give the IQ test to multiple people. And we start to compare the people from Harvard. Where are the Harvard people? Let them stand in for the intelligent ones, okay? Yale. And then, Yale, we're going to compare it to the Yaleys, okay? Yeah, there's the, okay, we got more. Yeah, I should have chosen Yale first. There are more of them here. All right, and then we're going to compare them. And you might say, well, if the Yale people answer the question correctly, it must not represent intelligence. Right? That's the Harvard people, they're doing the test, right? It must not represent intelligence. So you start to winnow away at the operations to try to figure out which operations actually correspond to an instance of the thing of your conceptual definition. All right?
All right, so that's step three. We start to winnow away the operations, and we try to get to a point where we have the operations there so that every time we give the test, yes, there's intelligence, or yes, there's virtue. All right? All right. But then there's a fourth step, and that's where you start to wonder whether or not your original conceptual definition was correct or not. Okay? Now, in the philosophy of social science, or in the philosophy of the human sciences, or psychology even, this process of defining, operationalizing, testing, and redefining is called a conceptual funnel. The idea is you just kind of keep getting down and closer to the real definition of the instance that you're trying to find in the world that matches the concept. Okay? Well, that could also be an epistemological circuit, right? Where you just wind up chasing your own tail, right? Trying to get to the point. So what happens is that our oftentimes in the philosophy of social science, our concepts become unmoored from reality in that way. So now we don't look for an instance of intelligence, but the test itself tells us what intelligence is. Okay? So this happens all the time in the philosophy of social science. So we have to be extremely careful for the way that we go about defining these terms, okay?
So we have to look at them carefully.
All right. Third movement. I actually want to say that the rise of modern neuroscience, I realize that there are many different definitions of what neuroscience is. I want to say that modern neuroscience is actually the fusion of two separate sciences. One is grounded more in the traditions of the hard science of biology, and the other is social science or the human sciences. And we have to fuse those together, right? And each one of these two separate sciences has their own traditions of making truth claims, right? They have their own traditions of making truth claims. One is grounded in the philosophy of social science, one is grounded in natural philosophy or the philosophy of natural science, right? But we try to take these two traditions and fuse them together to try to make correlations between the biology and the social science or the human sciences, okay? All right, so that's what I'm taking neuroscience to be.
Now, I realize many people in this room probably are neuroscientists and they may disagree with that, but that's what I mean when I'm talking about neuroscience. Third movement, we're going to look at some neuroscience now.
Okay. It typically goes, Meyer, Lindenberg, and others in the Proceedings of the National Academy of the Sciences in 2006 put forward this idea that they proclaimed that we found the missing link between genes and behavior, and we found it in the brain. Okay? So we have this idea that things go from genes to brains to behavior, ground up. Genes to brains to behavior. All right? So it turns out that there is a higher propensity for something we call antisocial personality disorder. Now remember, antisocial personality disorder is a social scientific concept, right? It had to go through this process before we could pick out an entity known as an antisocial person, right? All right. We found that there is a propensity of people who have the polymorphism in the promoter region of monoamine oxidase A. Monoamine oxidase A is an enzyme that breaks down the monoamines, serotonin, norepinephrine, and all these other neurotransmitters, okay? And if you have a polymorphism is not an abnormal gene. It's really hard to say what abnormal is in genes, okay? It turns out that some group of every population will have genes that aren't quite as effective at doing their job as they are in the larger herd of people, okay? So it's not a dysfunctional gene, it's just an inefficient gene. It's not really that good at doing what everybody else's does. Well, it turns out that if I have the polymorphism in the promoter region of monoamine oxidase A, okay, and you compare me to Father Gregory, it's going to be more likely that people like me with that polymorphism are going to be diagnosed with antisocial personality disorder in my life. Okay? All right. And it turns out that if you have the polymorphism in the promoter region of monoamine oxidase A, right, you will also have a smaller amygdala. And the amygdala is sort of the fight or flight mechanism. Okay? Smaller. It also is hyperfunctional. So it fires off at the drop of a hat. And in addition to that, the cingulate gyrus is also hypofunctional. The cingulate gyrus is in the frontal cortex, and the cingulate gyrus is what puts the brakes on the amygdala. So I no longer have any brakes, and I'm hyper-responsive in the amygdala, and so when Stephen makes a weird look at me, I get mad right away. Sorry, I keep getting on you. Right. I see that weird look, I'm like, oh, I'm ready to fight. Okay? So people say, aha, gene, polymorphism in the promoter region of monoamine oxidase A, to brain, my hyper-responsive amygdala, my hypo-responsive cingulate gyrus, to behavior, I'm ready to fight. Okay? All right. So this is what they declared. Aha, it does go genes to brain to behavior. Here's a problem, however. It turns out that of the people with the polymorphism in monoamine oxidase A, in the promoter region of monoamine oxidase A, not all of them are diagnosed with antisocial personality disorder. And in fact, the scans done on these people who had the polymorphism, not a single one of them had been diagnosed with antisocial personality disorder, at least according to the methodologies and samples of the people that they scanned their heads, okay? In other words, there is by no means a one-to-one relation of gene-brain behavior, okay? All right. This is an elegant, beautiful study, okay? This is by Caspi et al., and Caspi took a bunch of, okay, so in New Zealand, they do a fantastic job of keeping social services records, and every child that is entered into social services has an extensive record, okay? They take blood from them, and they have all of the, they have all of the records about where they are, and it's longitudinal. It's across about 20 years, plus 20 plus years, okay? Now, it turns out that if you look at an environmental factor like childhood maltreatment compared to one of these scales, an operational definition of antisocial personality, right? You've got a composite index of antisocial personalities. It took several operational tests and they combined them together with a composite score, so that they then could compare it to other things. Well, it turns out that if you have the polymorphism, that's this black line, the darker line, and you had no childhood maltreatment, the chances of you being diagnosed with antisocial personality disorder are no worse than if you do not have the polymorphism. And it turns out that if you have probable childhood maltreatment, there's still no difference between the two groups. It is only those who have the polymorphism, as well as severe documented maltreatment, that those kids will go on to be diagnosed as having antisocial personality disorder. So by no means is it gene to brain to behavior. It's gene happening in an environment, right, that may or may not lead to antisocial personality disorder, okay? So we see this becoming already problematized even amongst the scientists. So the science doesn't even tell us gene-brain behavior, even though that's how a lot of times we end up thinking about it. Most scientists are sophisticated enough not to do that, but if you look at the way what gets put out in the culture, oh yeah, genes-brain behavior, that's how we think about it, right? These findings have been reproduced in other studies. This one was with serotonin and not with the polymorphism. This is actually the one that looked specifically at serotonin, okay? So these have been reproduced. These are called gene by environment studies, okay? And they're really interesting and really complex, and they can give us really interesting information. Okay, but what sense do we say that a functional polymorphism is a disorder?
if the person never expresses antisocial behavior. All right? And in what sense does a hyper-responsive amygdala or a down-regulated cingulate gyrus mean that you have a disorder? Right? These findings are not diagnostic in any way, shape, or form. Okay? So we have to be very careful about what we're willing to say. Now that is something called antisocial personality disorder. That's the negative side. That's vice. Okay? And it turns out that vice is the way we talk about vice, we operationalize it as antisocial personality disorder. Okay? This one looks at virtues. Okay? This is done, this is not really a study, it's more of an opinion piece that met with rave reviews when it was published. Came out in 2009 in the Archives of General Psychology, and General Psychiatry, rather. They wanted to look at wisdom. And they were like, okay, what is wisdom? We have to come up with a conceptual definition of wisdom. Okay? So they did that. And then they had to come up with the subcomponents of wisdom. Okay? And those ended up being these six things. And these are the virtues that create wisdom. Okay? So notice this first one, pro-social attitudes and behaviors. Now I'm going to tell you how they derived this in just a minute. Social decision-making and pragmatic knowledge of life. Emotional homeostasis. Okay? Value relativism and tolerance. Acknowledgement of and dealing effectively with uncertainty and ambiguity. Okay? Now, how did they get these sub-virtues, or these sub-components, these virtues, as their definition of wisdom? This is the one where they said, you can read the Hindu scriptures or the Hebrew scriptures, or you can look to Jesus Christ or to Mahatma Gandhi, and you can come up with these, but they didn't do any of that. So the way they did it is they found 10 definitions in the psychological literature. Okay, 10 definitions of wisdom in the psychological literature. And if any 3 of those 10 definitions had something that sounded kind of similar to the others, it became a subcomponent. So, pro-social attitudes and behaviors, they found there were 10 definitions they looked at in the psychological literature. 5 of them had something that sounded kind of like pro-social attitudes and behaviors. So it made the list of one of the subcomponents of and one of the virtues of wisdom. Okay? Social decision-making, pragmatic knowledge of life, that one I think had 4. Okay? So each one of them had at least 3. Well, so let's look more closely at these definitions. We're going to pull pro-social attitudes and behaviors out, and we're going to look specifically at the 5 definitions that they drew on in order to get this as one of their subcomponents. Okay? So, they pulled a cognitive psychologist's work. His name is Baltus. He is a German psychologist. He has over 25, now he probably has 30 years worth of studies that thinks of wisdom as a cognitive ability, okay? And he's got a vast amount of literature they could have chose from, okay? Interesting, though, they chose a definition that he had put in that was in the proceedings of the Psychological Association of Nebraska or something like that. So it wasn't even one of their big definitions. It wasn't even published in the literature. They pulled a definition that was part of a paper that was never published. Interestingly, I just found that bizarre. Brilliant psychologist and a researcher. Very, very solid in the way he does things. But they also found a person named Ardelt. And Ardelt has a definition that's almost antithetical to Baltus. Okay? Her definition is based in not cognitive psychology, but emotional psychology, right? She sees wisdom as an emotional thing and not a cognitive thing, okay? So they have 2 competing ways of thinking about it. Now, you could say, oh, but they both had something like pro-social attitudes and behaviors in their definition, and so it must be right because it has both the emotional and the cognitive people saying it, right? That's one way of looking at it. Or you look at it, these are two fundamentally different theoretical positions, right? And so are they conflicting with each other? Brown and Green. Brown and Green are, I don't know if they still do this in psychology, but back when I was an undergrad, if you took psychology 101, one of the ways to get extra credit was?
Study.
Yes, right. Volunteer to be in the study. All right. So they asked a bunch of college students, what is your definition of wisdom? Now, I don't know if you've been on too many undergraduate campuses. Wisdom is not what pops to the forefront of my mind when I think about that. But that's what they did. They asked them, what's your definition? Okay. And it turns out that they had already done a conceptual definition study, and that the definition they pulled out was part of an operational study where they had actually created the operations, okay? So it was at a different stage than even Baltus and others, okay? Sternberg is really more of a philosopher of mind, sort of. I mean, he's a psychologist by training, but his work is really more like philosophy of mind. He also has a very theoretical definition. It's a composite definition for many different ways of thinking about it, okay? And then we have Jason et al. Who asked professors, because we know professors are really wise, right? And they had like 50 professors, and they asked the professors, well, give us an example of wisdom, and then tell us what you think wisdom is. You know, they got names like Mahatma Gandhi as an example, or Jesus Christ as an example. One professor put herself, or himself, okay? And one professor put a free-roaming whale, okay? As their exemplar for wisdom, okay? But their definition met the criteria, or met the same standards as the others. And each one of these is cited as support for pro-social attitudes and behaviors being part of the definition of wisdom, okay? So Meeks and Jesse do all of this up front in the first part of their paper. In the second part of their paper, where they're trying to get to the definition. This is a terrible slide, sorry. What they did was they looked at, retrospectively, they started saying, okay, which studies in the literature, and there are probably about 12, 15 studies listed up here, which studies in the literature sort of had something like pro-social attitudes and behaviors, and where do we find on the genome the things being expressed that were being measured? Okay? In other words, they were trying to correlate pro-social attitudes and behaviors created by this social scientific philosophy, right? And try to correlate it to what's going on in people's genes. Okay? And they say, if you look carefully, pro-social attitudes and behaviors are mediated by the DRD4, the DRD5 polymorphisms associated with self, you know, all this other stuff, right? So they said, the neurotransmitter for pro-social attitudes and behaviors is dopamine, serotonin, vasopressin, and oxytocin. And the neurotransmitters associated with emotional homeostasis are dopamine, serotonin and norepinephrine. Okay. So they took their concept and they began to map it onto the genes. And the genes that express certain of these neurotransmitters, okay? In addition to that, and they said, we found it. Here are the genes that are pro-social attitudes and behavior genes, right? And they said, but we can do the same thing to the brain. So let's look at brain studies. And each of these brain studies have different methodologies. Some of them are fMRI. Some of them are, PET scanning. Who knows what else they are, okay? There's so many of them that they cite. And they began to say, okay, putative subcomponents of wisdom, pro-social attitudes and behaviors associated with cognitive emotional tasks, moral sensitivity, we find that in the posterior cingulate cortex. In other words, they take the social scientific concepts, not only are they mapping them onto the genes, they're then mapping them onto the brain. Okay? So we have these ideas, these social ideas, and we then began to try to say, what is virtue? Virtue is pro-social attitudes and behaviors. Where do we find it?
We've mapped it onto the brain. Here's where we find prosocial attitudes and behaviors, which includes the anterior, the posterior cingulate cortex, the superior temporal sulcus, and the medial prefrontal cortex.
Okay? All right. So this is how we do some neuroscience, all right? All right. What we probably have here, which is kind of scary, is an inverse phrenology. Who remembers what the science of phrenology was, right? Yeah, it didn't go so well. So we're beginning to want to, we want to have these scans that tell us something about people's behaviors. We want to have a scanning of their genome to see, oh, well, what are you going to be? Unless you think I'm crazy, there are people out there who say we ought to do this, okay? If our well-being depends upon the interaction between events in our brains and events in the world, and there are better and worse ways to secure it, then some cultures will tend to produce lives that are more worth living than others. Some political persuasions will be more enlightened than others, and some worldviews will be mistaken in ways that cause needless human misery. That's Sam Harris, who wrote the book. He fancies himself to be a neuroscientist. It's hard to say what he really is. He's really a public intellectual, I would say. Or we look here. Let's look at this now. So Meeks and Jesty, that was the study that looked at wisdom and the prosocial attitudes and behaviors. They said this: wisdom is considered an important contributor to successful personal and social functioning. Understanding the neurobiology of wisdom may have considerable clinical significance. For example, knowledge of the underlying mechanisms could potentially lead to the development of preventative, therapeutic, and rehabilitative interventions for enhancing wisdom, including those designed for persons with relevant neuropsychiatric disorders. In other words, if we know something about it, we can do some good with this, right? And that makes some good sense. That makes some really good sense, right? We also have to compare that to what people like Sam Harris, Adrian Rain, and some of the others are saying, which is we can start scanning people's brains and we can see, well, you can see that I have the polymorphism, and therefore we're going to watch you, Jeff. If we look at these virtues, these subcomponents, this sound, pro-social attitude behavior, social decision-making, pragmatic knowledge, emotional homeostasis, reflection, self-understanding, value, relativism, tolerance, acknowledgement of and dealing effectively with uncertainty. Now, those are virtues that you might find a kind of, I don't know, maybe a political Democrat might have, right? You can imagine a libertarian having different values, like personal responsibility, right? So we already see that there's a political element being built into the way we think of virtues and vices, right? Because I could come up with other kinds of virtues that libertarians might like, and I can guarantee you I can find them in the brains of people too, right? So what do we make of this, right? In other words, these might already be political in the so-called social science, right? All right, and a few people are calling for genetic enhancement of virtue. Mark Walker, Enhancing Genetic Virtue, a Project for the 21st Century Humanity, published in Politics and Life Sciences. All right, the idea is that, hey, if you've got the polymorphism in the promoter region of monoamine oxidase A, maybe we ought to think about, you ought to think about whether you should procreate, okay? Or maybe we start screening embryos that have the polymorphism and we can select them out, right? You can imagine any number of ways that we could select that out. Now, what's fascinating about this idea is that a polymorphism has inclusive fitness, right? It exists in the herd because it seems, the theory is that it exists in the herd because it has some sort of evolutionary benefits. So it has inclusive fitness. It seems to lead to better herd survival, for instance, right? So polymorphism isn't even an abnormal thing, and yet we could start screening for it and selecting it out, right? Others are arguing that if we can make people more moral through technological enhancement, and I think Stephen's going to talk about this, we ought to do it. So we get people who want to argue for moral enhancement. Julian Savulescu and Igmar Persson have written a whole book called Unfit for the Future, where they say, you know what, we're in sort of a, a, a,
We're in a kind of crisis. And because we're in this crisis, we need to enhance our morality, right? So that we might survive the crisis. Some of us might be unfit for the future, is what they're saying, okay? So these things cash themselves out in real potential policies and real potential cultural phenomena, right? So, Albert Einstein says, science can only ascertain what is, but not what should be. And outside its domain, value judgments of all kinds remain necessary. But what I've said is that maybe science doesn't tell us what is, it tells us what we think is important to see, which is already value-laden. In other words, science is always value-laden. We ask the question precisely because we think there's a moral importance of asking the scientific question, right? So maybe Einstein was wrong on this front.
Wrong on the first part of it. All right? So I'll end here.
This is not a brain. It's an fMRI of a brain. It is not a virtue. It is not a vice. It is not antisocial personality, right? It is a constructed image that looks for what we think is important. So science is value-laden all the way up and all the way down.
So I was wondering if your primary criticism is directed toward sort of the science itself or the philosophical underpinnings of it, because it doesn't seem that implausible that, like, genes can have some effect on neurotransmitters,
sure,
which could have some effect on behavior.
Sure.
So is that... Do you think that, essentially, if we reconstructed this science based on, like, a Thomistic account of wisdom, that it would have any value?
So what I... I gotta go over here to the mic. Yeah, sorry. Yeah, what I would say is that you've got to whatever the science is, you have to understand that the science itself is built in a kind of philosophical system. It emerges out of a philosophical system. Is Thomas's account the right account, or is Thomas also in the midst of an inquiry that is we've just inherited? Right. I mean, Thomas is always open to the next question. Well, the next questions that we have are the neuroscientific questions, right? Thomas would be dealing with these neuroscientific questions, right? And kind of sizing it up about how it fits with what he said before and what he might have to reject from what he said before in order to be able to engage the science. So what I would say is that, I'm not going to say is Thomas absolutely correct on everything that Thomas has ever said. What I will say is that we have to be aware of the philosophical underpinnings out of which any science emerges, whether it be Thomistic philosophy or Kantian philosophy or, some sort of Popperian understanding of the philosophy of science, right? So every one of them has these sort of value-laden up and down throughout the way they are constructed, and so we have to be able to engage that, which means we can't just do science. I mean, the PhD in biology or neuroscience, if you think about it, it's a doctor philosophy degree. Let's do some philosophy. Let's get back to some of that part of it and ask the philosophical questions about the nature of the underpinnings of the how the science emerges as facts. Any scientist worth his or her salt will always say, well, based on the experimental boundaries or the experimental conditions, this is what I can say is true. Outside of that, I don't know if I can say what's the case, right? So I think scientists themselves want to be careful, except for a few like Sam Harris or Julian Savulescu, right? They don't want to have that epistemological humility about the nature of how their question emerged and to begin with. They just assume that they are right about it. That's what I would say. Is it Thomas? Yeah, possibly. I think of myself as a Thomist, though most Thomists would probably reject me. I feel like, I think of myself as a Thomist, but and I feel like I've reached the pinnacle of my career. I'm at the Thomistic Institute. However, I'm not sure most Thomists think I'm a Thomist, so.
So I have two brief questions. The first is, do you have any possible solutions or practices that we should adopt to address this? Like philosophical disclosures in scientific papers? And then do you see that some fields are significantly more affected by these kind of assumptions compared to other fields?
Yeah. So are there practices that are there? Well, actually, science is a set of practices, right? You've got your methodologies that you use. If you think about the people who actually do the science in the laboratory, the people that do the science in the laboratory usually isn't the top scientist in the group. It's usually a lab tech who can actually get the experiments to work. The top scientists can't get them to work. So there's a set of practices. They won't even let them near it. You talk to these lab techs, and they're like, keep him out of here because he's going to screw up the experiments, right? Well, there are already practices around that that are there in actually carrying out the experiment. In addition to that, we then have to become practiced at, well, what do these results mean? And this is what I say. Most scientists, the vast majority of scientists, are pretty circumspect about they have practices of interpretation that prevent them from making these broad stroke claims. The problem is it's the broad stroke claims that get them published, right? And then get them onto NPR or ABC News, Nightly News, right? So there's always this tendency to kind of overly sensationalize a finding. And most scientists don't want that, but at the same time, they like the press, right? So there have to be moral practices around reflection that scientists actually have. Do you need to disclose the philosophical assumptions? It would have been nice if these people would have said, you know, there might be other values that we're not studying, right? You can think of libertarianism has a different set of fundamental personal responsibility, self-motivation, all of those kinds of things. I promise we could find something in the brain that lights up, you know, when we ask those kinds of questions. So I think it does require some philosophical disclosure or you know, that we chose this and it sure looks like a certain kind of political philosophy that's animating our questions. That would be nice. But I don't know because we've always had in modern science this idea of facts and values. I'm dealing with the facts. Rest of you, you know, I don't know what you're doing. I got the facts. Well, that's part of the problem. Is the naturalistic fallacy is already kind of animating modern natural science, right? That's David Hume, right? So it starts with the David Hume, who's also a political philosopher.
I just had a kind of question about the studies where, you know, from my understanding, the brain is kind of like a bidirectional organ, and so our actions are going to change, you know, habits, virtues, in like the true sense, are going to change our brain. And so I wonder if you know of any kind of studies where, you know, despite these problems, where the researchers looked at kind of like longitudinally, if people then practiced a virtue or however we're going to define that, did it change then the brain area?
I'm not aware of actual brain studies, but there are things And try to say something similar about cognitive behavioral therapy, which is really an attempt to scientifically study something that sounds awfully like a set of virtues that one has to practice repeatedly in order to become habituated into doing it. Now, are there brain studies that show this? I'm not aware of any, but I bet you could find them. I bet you could do something like that would show it. So what we believe is that the reductive scientist is always gene, brain, behavior, and then we got environment, which means that already we've got habits of how we deal with stress, right, or whatever, or the stresses that I've been given as a child that I don't know how to process, right? Well, yeah, you might actually, the people who have the polymorphism but don't go on to that, they might actually have a community of people that have showed them how to process that through habituation and how to think through these things in less destructive ways. So I imagine you could find all of that the case, which means that there are some lateral things, not just ground up, there are lateral things. But then there's also top down, where my own awareness then begins to push back down on my biology, right, so that I can create habits, so that I can, you know, et cetera. So I imagine we can find all of that, and we need to be publishing those to show that these things are still very squishy. They are still very squishy, but they add a lot of texture over the top of what some of these kinds of tests studies.
Earlier today, over coffee, you mentioned that you're trying to do something in the scientific world that's similar to what Alistair McIntyre was doing,
yeah,
with the moral tradition, which, if I understand correctly, is something like deconstructing a certain kind of objectivity in what Alistair McIntyre was doing in the moral tradition. So I want to ask, I think, a question that was posed to him, which is that even though he says that he's trying to deconstruct modern emotivist moral tradition, naming it as a tradition, doing what you're doing, reminding us that the representation isn't the same thing as the thing itself, But then he also advocates returning back to an Aristotelian Thomistic moral tradition.
Yep.
But then people asked him, so what? How then do we adjudicate between the different traditions?
Yeah.
So I want to ask that of you in terms of the different scientific traditions. How do we adjudicate?
Do you think Alistair gave a good answer?
I don't know.
Yeah, yeah. Well, if you think he gave a good answer, I'm going to say turn to Alistair's answer. If you think he didn't give a good answer, I'm saying Alistair McIntyre couldn't answer that question, so I'm certainly not going to be able to. In all honesty, though, it's you know, I'm sort of. I mean, I think McIntyre's answer is sort of this answer. If you asked Alistair, "Are you a moral absolutist?" he would say, "Yes, but." And if you asked him, "Are you a moral relativist?" he would say, "Yes, but." Okay. And so he has a view of knowledge as historically and socially instantiated. And what we can say is true up to this point is provisionally true until we come across a problem that challenges what we have said is true. Okay? Now, I think we can probably say, first it was Aristotle, or Nietzsche, then it was Thomas, but then he actually, so that's in book two, Whose Justice, Which Rationality, becomes a Thomas, and then in Three Rival Versions, he becomes a Catholic, and he says, actually, it's a community of discernment, all right? So he actually moves from a metaphysical biology of a sort of Aristotelian through a kind of Thomism, and then he says there are too many Thomisms. Right? And so what we need is a community that helps us to adjudicate that, right? Well, that's in a way what I would say is that we need to have a community of people who can be thoughtful about these things and be honest about the limits of our knowledge up to this point, and to what extent does the next scientific study throw all of it into question, right? And then we have to sit down together and think through it and do this process of kind of trying to get to it, right? So that would be my answer, is that science, who you know, do any of us have the God's eye view here, you know? Apart from the revelation of God and Jesus Christ, you know, the incarnation, that we can't say much more about that just in terms of what we can achieve using science and reason and all these other things. It's always a process, and it's always historically instantiated. So that's what I would say, yeah.
I was wondering what you would say in terms of adding another factor into this whole progression for brain injury, because as practicing physicians, so we see damage and disease processes that actually many patients are able to compensate for a long time, if not their whole life, that doesn't always, but sometimes affects
it breaks behaviors. Through in some way, exactly. Yeah.
Yeah.
We are finite creatures. and so the point is well made and well taken. I mean, we you know, you get damage to a certain area of the brain, and I'm fond of the kind of way that large communities, given some of the things that just came out in the press, you know, God help us, have mercy. But we can create social practices that kind of gather around those people, and the people who do best. So sister, you ought to join us at the conference on medicine and religion sometime. It's a really good conference, and we deal with questions like that, and a couple of papers that have been presented there have been about patients with PTSD, psychiatric disorders, and how they do so much better if they live in a parish community, if they have a group of people who are going to take up for them, fill in the gaps where they can't, you know, and be tolerant of them, hopefully, probably get mad at them as well, and all of the other things that human emotion enters into. But I think there are ways, and then there might be medications, that's another way of controlling some of it, and sometimes we might say, oh, probably shouldn't use the medications in these instances. We need some prudence about that. So I think that this is sort of the McIntyrean answer, is that we need the church. We need, you know, it has to be a community of people who are actually trying to live out the good and with each other, and that we actually are dependent rational animals. That's his fourth book that is important. We are actually dependent upon one another, and we need each other in order to do this. Even those of us who are supposedly really brilliant, we need, like that brilliant scientist, he needed that lab tech to get his experiments to work.
Hi.
Was interested in what you were saying when you're talking about how Einstein tells us what is, and you were saying maybe science is telling us what we think is important. So I wonder if you could just elaborate on how you, as a scientist, relate to the notion of an objective truth.
Yeah. So I'm not a practicing scientist. Okay. I'm not a practicing scientist. I have done bench research. And again, I would say that, you know, what is objective truth? I believe in moral absolutes, but I'm not sure I possess it, right? I'm not sure I have the absolute truth about the nature of the brain. I believe there is a matter of the fact there, but we are always filtering it through our concepts and our values and all of these other processes. And so what I would have to say is that we need to be humble enough to let people open us up to these hard questions about, well, what are you saying is true here? And how is that truth instantiated in this set of experiments? And is that transposable? Is that generalizable beyond the experiment? And given that objects do not go into their concepts without kind of overflowing them, right? I think we have to have a little bit of humility about proclaiming what is absolutely true, both scientifically or even morally to some extent.
We have time for two or three more questions, and I'm going to ask one of them.
Okay.
So I'm interested in this notion of certainty. So the I'll ask a question, then I'll say some things, and then I'll just repose it. So what is the notion of certainty operative in your kind of vision? And I guess in the background, now that McIntyre has been broached, I figure let's go for it. So McIntyre talks a lot about dialectical knowledge, right? This whole like process of epagoge, whereby one, you know, kind of like progressively sifts both principles and conclusions in the very prosecution of a discipline, you know, taken together in a communal setting as craft or practice. But there is, he has, you know, like he's very concerned, I think it's in the preface of the second edition, that like people would think him a relativist. And so he wants to supply some grounds for a kind of certainty, and he goes back to metaphysical biology for just this reason. And now we're talking about dolphins.
Exactly. Dolphin behavior.
Like, what in the world? Where did this come from? Right. So he wants to give you some access to it, right? And it seems to me, you also mentioned like Popper and this notion that science proceeds up to a certain point and then it just shifts.
And then it proceeds
up to a certain point and then it just shifts.
Do
you think there is like in the philosophy of science or in the praxis of what you've described here, is there real like metaphysical terra firma for grounding certain claims? And is it just based on operationalization? Or like, you know, or is there something else there that can be actually grasped?
So this is the hardest part because it does sound like I'm a relativist, and I'm not a relativist, right? what I would say is that I can be wrong, and I need to be willing to admit that I can be wrong. There are certain things that I will say that you'd have to present some pretty compelling information, some pretty compelling evidence to make me think that a fetus is not a human fetus, it's not a human, right? What evidence could they ever provide, you know, to say that, right, that it's not. So I can't imagine certain things as possibilities, but I also have to realize that I need to strike a humble stance towards that, because there might be some dimension of my absolute truth that I have to back out of in some way. So, again, I don't have the God's eye view. and I do think we can say, up to this point, we have settled that this is, in fact, a truth. But we have to be open to what shows up on the horizon, so I think it's always yes, but hold on, let's move gently into that abyss of that question, right? The question opens up something, so that would be my answer, is that of course I can't imagine any piece of evidence that would ever have me question that truth, right? But that's because my imagination might be fallen or broken, and you know, maybe there's something that will pop up. But I don't see that happening, right? And I think that's true for a lot of scientists. And if you just take scientific facts, I mean, you think about the way that scientific facts work. I mean, Newtonian physics didn't work, and so we get Einstein's theory of relativity, and that didn't work. That worked up to a point, but then it didn't work, and then we have quantum. That starts to fall apart at the edges as well. And so what will be the next way of reformulating the whole thing? You know, and to me, that's how science moves, including moral knowledge, moral science as well.
Hi. So I was wondering if it was possible to have a purely descriptive methodology science, especially in hard sciences, given a defined boundary of your inquiry, of what you're trying to find, and your methodology, in fact, specified. And because it seems to me that, like, for certain kinds of inquiries within hard sciences, it would be there. It isn't value. There isn't any kind of value that is kind of implicit in these studies.
Yeah, yeah. There's no obvious moral value there at one level. So let me make two points. There still are aesthetic values at work. The simplest explanation is more likely to be the correct one. What's your evidence for that? Right? That's a value. That's an aesthetic value, but it's a value for which there's no hard evidence. The world looks pretty darn complex to me. And so complexity might actually be multiple competing ideas, right, that are animating certain phenomena in the world, right? So they're already, the Occam's razor is already a kind of aesthetic value. In addition to that, most scientists engage in science because they want the pure joy of knowing. The wow factor, right? The thing that just kind of shows up and you didn't expect it, that's when the scientist goes, wow, this is the coolest thing ever. Well, that's the kind of aesthetic value as well that kind of animates the scientist wanting to move forward with his or her questions, all right? So while there may not be moral values packed into that, there are certainly aesthetic values, and those are still values for which you can't necessarily give some sort of scientific evidence prior to it. Third thing is, if we're asking a question about the nature of physics, I don't know, subatomic particles and their behaviors under certain kinds of circumstances, or astronomical bodies, black holes, whatever, right? If we're spending money to ask those kinds of questions, we've already said, you know what, we're going to forego other kinds of questions that actually have moral import. And I would say that those are therefore have animating them a certain kind of moral value. That the aesthetic, the wow, the joy of knowing is somehow saying we ought not be studying malaria. Why are we spending so much money on what's going on out there? So already culture is making some value judgments about, and these are now moral value judgments, about the importance of the wow, the importance of the joy of knowing, or the aesthetic part of it, right? And so I would say that as a cultural phenomenon, you actually see multiple layers of value already at work in it. I mean, you may disagree, and you can push back, of course, but...
It seems to me here that there's a value for doing this activity, and as a kind of as you're saying, there's aesthetic value and so on. But then my question is not the value for doing this activity, but the value is engaged within the methodology.
Exactly, yeah. But that's a good question. And maybe at the methodological level, it doesn't quite cash out, except insofar as you choose certain kinds of methodologies over other methodologies based on practical matters that you have at your hand. Maybe it'll give you better or harder evidence that will help you. So I do think there's still some sort of value being deployed in choosing a certain kind of methodology, but maybe not quite in the way that it may not shape the findings in a way, but it does shape the question that might be asked.